please take a seat. And if you can get sight of 2 John, that would be fantastic. This kind of brings an end to our little series. It has been a little series of little books. Our postcards from the early church, as we called them. 2 John is another of these small but powerful letters. If you're familiar with the film Men in Black, you might recall Will Smith's character at the beginning. He's introduced to this world where everything is not as it first appears. It's a world in which aliens have not only landed on Earth, but they live among us, disguised, living ordinary, everyday lives. Things aren't as they first appear. And Will Smith's character, he's issued with this weapon, this noisy cricket, as it's called. It's a tiny little puny little alien-looking gun compared with the great big kind of cannon that his partner carries. Except when he uses it for the first time, it's so powerful that the recoil sends him flying across the room. It might look insignificant and tiny, but it packs quite a punch. The same, I hope, we'll see with the second letter of John. Now, the Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year 2016 shortlisted a number of words relatively new to the dictionary. Let me just point out a couple of my favourites. The first one, if it comes up, is Hygge. Hygge is a quality of cosiness and comfortable conviviality. That's a good word in itself. That engenders a feeling of contentment or well-being. It comes from this Danish idea. There's no English equivalent, but essentially it means all wrapped up warm in lots of wool and sitting on a cozy sofa by the fire, sipping hot chocolate from a big mug. That kind of thing. Hygge. The second is adulting. Adulting. It's the practice of behaving in a way characteristic of a responsible adult, which comes as a bit of a shock to some of us, especially the accomplishment of mundane but necessary tasks. I'm sure Richard won't mind me telling you that it was his birthday yesterday, and he was enjoying himself so much he thought he'd treat himself to fitting a new washer-dryer, was it? Okay. But that a classic case of adulting. No time for fun. No, just got to fix the washer-dryer, or at least attempt it. Well done, Richard. But these were only runners-up. The word of the year was, in fact, it comes up here, post-truth. Post-truth. It's an adjective defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. Now, the phrase may have been coined in the early 90s, but it took on a frightening relevance in the events of last year, especially in the world of politics. To say that that politicians lie might be tantamount to saying that grass is green or the sky is blue, but post-truth is different to simple lies, which might stand up against the truth and hopefully are shown to be false. But no, post-truth describes a world where truth itself is made increasingly irrelevant. One political commentator concluded that the truth has become so devalued that what was once the gold standard of political debate is worthless currency. When a lie that might be so easily disproved with verifiable fact gathers momentum and sways public opinion, it is simply outgrown truth. Truth is rendered powerless compared to feelings, to our feelings that are fueled by prejudice. Why should the facts change my opinion when my opinion is so strongly held? That's post-truth. And many commentators are saying that that is the world we live in now. We live in a post-truth age. Point one, we live in a post-truth age. But just because post-truth has finally entered the dictionary doesn't mean that it's something new. No. Just because it's been given a name, it's been identified, we know what it looks like now, doesn't mean it's lost any of its power. The age of post-truth began long before the American presidential election, long before the EU referendum. John here writes about the dangers of the post-truth age that he lived in late in the first century AD. Now let's explore what he was up against. Now John has lived a remarkably long life. For an apostle, he's the only one of the 12 who made it to old age, despite much persecution and suffering. He writes his gospel account with the events that he witnessed firsthand, fresh in his mind, thanks to the Spirit's work, and coloured with years of experience as a follower of Christ and as a leader of the church. Let's take a look at what he writes in his gospel. He describes Jesus as the Word who became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory in John 1, verse 14. The Word became flesh. And towards the end, he explains that his gospel, John's gospel, is written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. John 20, verse 31. And right at the end, John himself he's described as the disciple who is bearing witness about these things, and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. John 21, 24. Now, probably after this gospel is circulated, he writes these letters, 1, 2, and 3 John. Now, personally, I quite like the theory that 1 John, the longest of them, was designed for a wide distribution across the churches, while 2 and 3 John were the personalized covering letters to specific congregations. 1 John lays out an important message for everybody. True believers must believe that Jesus truly is the Christ come in the flesh, and that this belief must work itself out in righteousness and love. Notice that Christ's bodily appearance on this earth is vital to our faith. If God himself didn't come in the flesh to live alongside John and his friends, die for them in front of his eyes and physically appear to him, risen again, then we may as well not bother if none of those things were true. We may as well not bother. His second letter, John's second letter, really drives home this message to a particular audience, a church he describes as the elect lady and her children. He warns them that there were those who were going around denying that Jesus came in the flesh. There in verse 7. Now, who were these deceivers? Who would deny that? Well, we don't have much to go on apart from this main point here, that they did not believe that God became man in Jesus Christ. Any other details regarding their identity would be probably unnecessary at any rate. They deny Jesus as God. What else do we need to know about them to know that they are peddling a false gospel? It's the same theme with every cult, every false religion. We know they're false because they do not acknowledge Jesus as God. For example, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they will admit that Jesus is God's Son. They will explain how the world was created through him, and they will confess that he died for us. They'll even say, yes, he is a God. But they won't go as far as to say that he is in fact God himself. It's an obstacle, a sticking point that they cannot get over. But we can't explain how there can be one God, yet he exists in three persons. So we're going to deny it. We're going to deny what we can't explain. And all the other crazy stuff about them not wanting to receive blood transfusions, or how heaven only has room for 144,000 people, or any of the other rubbish that they go on about, these are trivial mistakes compared to the fatal error of denying Jesus his rightful place in the Godhead. We live in a post-truth age, where truth itself, verifiable fact, that is events that can be checked to see if they're true, well, they're considered irrelevant compared to strongly held personal belief. Soon after I became a Christian, a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses came to our door, and I knew they were wrong. I did know that they were wrong, but I was arrogant enough to think that I could change their minds through reasoned argument. I thought they must be reasonable people. I can be reasonable with them. I went along to their meetings. I was a young Christian. I went along to their meetings and I met with their leaders to try to convince them that they were wrong, with no discernible effect whatsoever, of course. Except that after some time, my own minister noticed a change in me. Without realizing it, I'd let their false teaching into my own heart, and it would have cost me my faith. If he hadn't pulled me back and warned me against associating with such people, spending time with such people, sitting under such teaching. Be careful who you let into your home. Be careful what you listen to. Be careful what you read. Lies can lodge themselves so deep that no amount of truth can shift them, because we live in an age where truth has been robbed of its power. So John here calls us to win truth back its power. He calls us to walk in the truth. A second point, we're called to walk in the truth. Having mentioned truth, the word truth, four times in his opening greetings in verses 1 to 3, John, he's established the importance of truth within this letter. We're left in no doubt. And then he begins the main body of the letter by celebrating the good, that he sees in this church. Verse 4, he rejoices greatly that some are walking in the truth. And he leaves us in no doubt as to what he is talking about. John, he's not like some mystic guru who spouts vague ideas that, well, they may sound clever, but they don't actually hold any water. He's not like so many inspirational quotes on Facebook, which are, of course, pseudo-profound, vacuous rubbish. I found a few examples of the kind of thing that we might come across. The next slide, please. Thank you very much. Just because my path is different doesn't mean I'm lost, says one. Another says, don't cry over the past, it's gone. Don't stress about the future, it hasn't arrived. Live in the present and make it beautiful. Sounds lovely. Another says, give yourself permission to feel anger, pain, resentment. Relax then, let it glow with love. Beautiful words, utterly meaningless rubbish. Thank you. We'll take those off the screen. John, he's not like those inspirational quotes that we might come across in social media. No, John, he is concerned with immediately grounding the truth that he's talking about, immediately grounding it in reality. Firstly, he says, it's from the Father. It's from the Father. The ultimate authority of all truth is the source of what he's talking about. Secondly, we have had this truth. We've had it from the beginning. It's nothing new. It's nothing he's just invented, dredged up from it hasn't just Googled inspirational ideas. We've had it from the beginning. But although we've had it for so long, it's nonetheless capable of still surprising us. What is this truth? I hear you ask. What is it? That we love one another, verse 5. That we love one another. Love one another? Is that the best that you can come up with, John? Now that really does sound like a pseudo-profound, vacuous bit of rubbish. Love one another? Is that it? Well, it would be empty. It would be rubbish. If it was just John's words. Or if it was just my words. Something that I've just come up with. But thankfully, these aren't John's words. He's quoting Jesus, who at the Last Supper, John was there, sitting next to him. At the Last Supper, he says to his disciples, a new commandment I give you, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. John 13. Verse 34. John isn't writing a new commandment. He is indeed repeating an old one. Christ's words made more profound than even his disciples could have guessed. It's that casual little qualifier that Jesus drops in there. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. Just as I have loved you. Remember, this is the night before his death on the cross. And I bet those words came back to his disciples with such force of meaning and implication after the cross, after they considered what it really meant. That the love that he was talking about here, the love that he was talking about was grounded in the single greatest act of love in all history. The cross. He wasn't talking about a warm, fuzzy feeling that you get. It wasn't that kind of be my Valentine love. Far from it. He was talking about a big risk taking love, an excruciatingly painful love, a horrifically sacrificial love, an immensely costly love. That's the love that he's talking about. It's not just a throwaway, casual, empty comment to love one another. No, it is so rich and deep and weighty and powerful. We'll spend our whole lives trying to get our heads around it. John explains it further in his first letter. He says, God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we've loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. If God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. That's 1 John chapter 4, verses 8 to 11. Now, to walk in the truth is to follow Jesus' command, which comes with the highest authority and remains as unchanged and as steadfast as he does. That we love one another. And we do this by walking in his footsteps, even if that means to our death for the sake of others. John has done this, and he knew the only reason that it hasn't cost him his life yet is because it wasn't his turn. John was the walking embodiment of the truth at this time. He walked as one who had been first among those who were called by Jesus to follow him. He was one of the inner circle of disciples who witnessed things no one else did, such as Jesus' transfiguration. He was there at the cross. He was there at the empty tomb, and he met the risen Lord Jesus. Everyone else that had been there had died for their belief in that truth, that verifiable historical fact. Everyone else had died for it, except John. And that wasn't for lack of trying on John's part. It wasn't for lack of trying on his enemies' part. It was simply Christ's will that it wasn't his time yet. John, at this time, he walks as one following Jesus, and he rejoices greatly because he looks over his shoulder and he can see these young Christians right behind him, hot on his heels, also walking in the truth, walking in the truth. Jesus in front, and then there's the apostles, close behind, and their disciples, and behind them, there's their disciples, and there's a long train, all the way back here, ladies and gentlemen, all the way back to here. But John looks around and he can see another group. They've gone ahead without following Christ. They've made their own path. They've got their own new teaching, and they claim their own authority over it. These are deceivers that John warns us against in verses 7 to 10, saying we must reject them and their false teaching. Last point, point 3, we must reject false teaching. As I've said before, their false teaching centers around their simple denial of Christ. They have this profound misunderstanding over Christ's identity. They reject the idea that God's Son would come in human flesh. So Jesus can't possibly be God. Now, okay, it's far from agreed upon, but many scholars believe that this particular misunderstanding that we see here, that John's writing about, indicates perhaps a heresy that would later be called Gnosticism. Now, the Gnostics, they gained a lot of influence a century or so later, but this does sound like it could have been the beginning of their movement. Gnostic beliefs, they centered around the assumption that God is made of spirit, and spirit is good. But anything created, everything you see around you here, from the chairs, the trees outside, to even ourselves, well, we are made of matter, and matter is evil. Okay? God is spirit, which is good. We are matter, which is evil. All right? That's the sort of the overarching assumption. They hold this belief so strongly that they come up against a real problem when they're confronted with Jesus, of course, because the idea that God, who is good, could inhabit a human body which is evil just doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense. So what they're going to do is they're going to deny it. They're going to deny that Christ came in the flesh. Of course they are, because they're not going to compromise their strongly held beliefs. That comes first. That has the authority here. So they're going to struggle with the facts surrounding Jesus, which show that he is both fully human and fully God at the same time. Rather than believe in the facts, they're going to create their own. So this whole great big cult begins to grow out of the attempt to hold all these mismatched beliefs together. Try and keep it as a sort of a unified whole. And one way that they go about controlling their followers was to induct them into successive levels of knowledge and understanding. They're a little like perhaps the Freemasons, in that a new member of their cult was only allowed to know so much until they're promoted to the next level up. At that point, they're let in on another secret, but they still couldn't know everything until they reached the very top of the tree. We don't do that here. We don't do that. Nothing's kept hidden here. There's no clever theology that's only told to the upper echelons of the Mordown leadership. There are no secrets that Gary and Richard know that they aren't desperately trying to share with everyone else, week in and week out, from the front here. But the Gnostics, they'd forged on ahead, saying, well, Jesus was great for a start, but we know better now. We don't need him anymore. That's where their thinking had taken them. Follow us, they said. Follow us. We have secret knowledge. We know something special. What arrogance to think that you know better than Jesus, to claim a higher authority than God, to preach something new as if it supersedes Christ's commandment. John warns his audience against such false teachers. He says, he goes so far as to label them antichrists. He wants this church to be on the lookout for these deceivers with their special new teaching. And he wants them to put a stop to it by cutting off the oxygen that these false teachers rely on to keep them peddling their lies. Because if all the house churches turn these teachers away, then without so much as a greeting, then their heresy, well, it'll begin to lose its momentum. And the extent of the damage that they're doing will be limited. It's a loving command, as he tells them, don't welcome them into your church. Don't have them come and speak to you. Don't have them come and preach. Send them away. Send them packing. It's a loving command from a church leader who loves his flock and wants to protect them from the wolves. So what about us here at Moordown? Is the danger of heresy past now? Can we breathe a sigh of relief? There's no risk here. No. Certainly not. Certainly not. The risk remains. And the need for vigilance, for a ruthless a pursuit of the truth is still as relevant as ever. One contemporary example, perhaps, in the wider church, that is that of a movement it's known as the Emerging Church. It's become common on both sides of the Atlantic, but probably the strongest proponent of the movement in the UK has been a character called Steve Chalk. Now, he was a much-loved evangelical church leader, a pioneer of social action, and a popular author. But he shocked the wider church when he published a book titled The Lost Message of Jesus in 2003, in which he explains that the idea of a God of love venting his wrath on his own son is tantamount to cosmic child abuse. Now, this began a big debate. A lot of heavy hitters in the world of theology took this opportunity to really work hard at better explaining the cross and better communicating it to the world that we live in. So many good things came out of that discussion, there was a lot of healthy debate. But unfortunately, Chalk never backed down from his statement. And sadly, he's since shown that it would appear that he is taking a path away from Christ. That the things that he's continued to say and the way that he's continued to act shows that he is denying Christ. And he's led, of course, many down that same path that leads further and further from Christ's true gospel. Perhaps just as an indication of the danger of this this kind of arrogance, just in the title there, The Lost Message of Jesus implies that he's got some secret knowledge. There's almost an arrogance to it to say, I found out something new that everyone else has forgotten about. I've just dug it up. Something new about Jesus that we didn't know before. There's something arrogant in that. And it seems to have led him away from the truth. So dangerous. Continues to be such a risk. Let's continue to be vigilant. Let's continue to walk in the truth. This is our authority, our Bible, and let's do all we can to keep it so and to hold ourselves to account. To hold anyone that stands at the front here, anyone who leads any of our meetings to account. Myself, Richard, even Gary, to account. And they would want, and we would want that to be the case. I'm gonna pray before we sing again, and then Richard is gonna lead us in communion. Lord God, thank you for revealing yourself in truth, verifiable truth that we can hold on to so strongly. Lord, help us to stand against a culture that denies not just not just the truth, but the very, very concept that it might have any power or any authority over us. Help us to continue to proclaim your good news, and to stand against any hint of false teaching, and to be as ruthless as necessary to protect our own faith and the faith of those around us. In your name, amen.